I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guests on Radio Times today, Philadelphia Daily News reporters Barbara Laker and Wendy Ruderman, won a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting on Monday. Their 2009 series, Tainted Justice, is about the Philadelphia Police Department's narcotics field unit and allegations that members of the unit falsified search warrants in a number of drug cases. Ruderman and Laker also interviewed immigrant store owners who charged that narcotics officers raided their businesses, disconnected surveillance cameras, and looted merchandise and thousands of dollars in cash. The series led to investigations by Internal Affairs and by the FBI, as well as reforms in the police department and a review of numerous criminal cases. They join us today on Radio Times to talk about the series. Barbara Laker joined the Philadelphia Daily News back in 1993, where she has been a general assignment reporter, assistant city editor, and investigative reporter. Barbara Laker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. Wendy Ruderman joined the Philadelphia Daily News in 2007 after working for 5 years as a staff writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Wendy Ruderman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
And congratulations to both of you.
Thank you.
Here's the question that that everyone gets asked. How did you learn that you got a Pulitzer Prize, Wendy?
We learned the way everybody else learned at the exact same time at about a couple minutes after 3 o'clock. And we had no idea that we were going to win. And Michael Days wanted us to come up. Michael Days, the editor of the Philadelphia Daily News, wanted us to come over and look at the computer screen. And we kept hitting refresh on the Pulitzer page. And I kept thinking to myself, why am I standing here? You know, that little sliver of hope that I had been holding on to for a month or so was about to evaporate in a puff. And everyone was going to be standing around me saying, well, it was a good run. You know,
and then you found out that you won.
Yeah, an editor in the newsroom, Kevin Bevan, we heard him say, yes, yes, yes. and then I didn't even see our names on the page. Barbara and I just started jumping up and down and we cried a little bit.
I can only imagine. What does it mean to win a Pulitzer, Barbara?
It's something that you think, or I thought, that other people win. And it's a validation. It's people saying that, you know, I guess I am okay. Like, and because we were so close to it, I never thought that we'd win. And to me, it's like the ultimate.
Yeah. Well, and also you work in a local paper here in mm-hmm. Philadelphia, and as we know, these are newspapers that are under threat, holding on for dear life, and here you are working on this year-long investigation. Barbara, what was it like to actually work on this series? And I know some of it is looking at search warrants and looking at files and trying to figure out things on paper. What about the other part of it, where you're out in the community talking to people?
It was an adventure. It was a thrill. It was a high. I mean, we worked 12-hour days. We'd go up and down streets, knocking on hundreds of doors, some doors that were just plywood. People didn't live there anymore. And it was a thrill to meet people who every single person wanted to talk to us. And it was just an exciting, I mean, it's the reason I went into journalism. It was the reason I became a reporter, to do a story like this.
So people were not reluctant to talk to you? People on the street, in the stores, in the community?
Most people were not reluctant. I mean, there were some people who at first were hesitant to tell us what had happened to them, but we were surprised, actually, how welcoming they were. When you knock on someone's door or go to a store merchant and just ask them, we just want to know what happened, and they told us what happened. And I think it's one human being to another. I don't think they even saw me as a reporter. We were just two women asking people what happened.
This series went on for most of last year, Wendy, and I wonder about the response from the police department, from officers, from the union. What kind of response did you get?
Well, at one point, the union had a press conference specifically to attack the work that Barbara and I had done, and the attorney for the officers had hired a private investigator to sort of debunk the story and tear it apart, and they had come to this press conference with a big binder of materials. And I remember that when the press conference was over, all of the sudden, all the cameras that were there, like all the TV stations, turned around and they were, you know, putting the cameras on Barbara and I, you know, and it was a surreal feeling to feel like this press conference was specifically to attack us. And then writing it was very difficult because I struggled with the lead, and only because it was sort of trying to write something about myself that was critical of myself and Barbara. Mm-hmm. But honestly, we always believed in the story, so it didn't really rattle me very much. But I do have to say that we couldn't have done this story without super police sources who I really, really admire and care about.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because one could read the series and go away with the impression that you're anti-cop. Wendy?
Yeah, exactly. And that's really not the case at all. I mean, some of my cop sources, I know all about their lives. If anything happened to them, I would be horrified. Anything on the street. I know that they have dangerous jobs. I worry about them. They know about my family. I know about their family. They call me when something good happens to them. And I have a tremendous respect for what they do. In fact, I don't think I could do it. And I mean, they do. I mean, this sounds schmaltzy, but they do put their lives on the line. And we couldn't have done the story without some fantastic police officers who just felt like they were being tainted by this.
Indeed, and this was a series that went on for most of last year. Barbara, I know that you got attacked at one point doing this series, this story.
Yes, I did.
What happened?
I was talking to a... an informant's mom. I was in the mother's house, and the mom was telling me stuff about the relationship between one of the officers and her daughter, the informant. And it was information about, like, how the officer had come to her house and paid bail money out for her daughter. And the informant didn't want me talking to the mom and her mom talking to me. She didn't want this information out. So I was sitting in the living room. She came downstairs and walked over to me and threatened me and then took an open hand and slapped me across the face twice and then threw my notebook. And I was shaken, but I thought, I should probably get out of here.
I would think so.
So I ran across the room, picked up my notebook, ran out of the house, and called Wendy on the phone because the woman was chasing after me. And I remember just telling Wendy, "Wendy, she hit me, but it's okay. I have my notebook."
Right. A true reporter, right?
Yeah. And I have to add that,
Wendy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Barbara buys her own pens. She likes a specific pen. So she said, Wendy, I got the notebook, but I left one of my pens in there. And I said, for gosh sake, get back in there and get that pen.
So someone has a very nice pen?
Yes. No, they're really $2.39
pens. They're like
pens,
grocery store pens.
Yeah, they're my favorite pens.
Well, speaking of confidential informant, this story, and I'll put this to you, Wendy, really began with a confidential informant named Ventura Martinez, who spoke to you, both
right,
of you.
Right. He, basically, a source of mine had sent him to the office, and I wasn't really sure what he was going to say, and I was kind of busy, but I sat down with him, and he started telling me his story. And at one point, like, I think I was very skeptical because he had a criminal record. He was a former drug dealer. But he looked like he hadn't slept in days. His eyes were all red. He was clearly terrified, afraid that either he was going to get killed by one of the drug dealers he had turned against and helped the police officers with, or by the police, because he knew a lot of their baggage. And so he told me the story, and I at one point he got on the phone with police officer Jeffrey Chudik. He made a call to him on the cell phone, and they were going back and forth, and I was listening to the conversation. And after I had that initial conversation with him, I went to Barbara Laker, and I said, Barbara, I really think this is a story. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a difficult story. I think I'm going to need some help, and there's no one else in this room that I'd rather work with than you, because Barbara's very dogged, a wonderful writer, passionate, and kind of crazy, as you heard.
And it does begin with this relationship between a confidential informant, Ventura Martinez, and a member of this narcotic squad, a guy named Jeffrey Chudik.
Correct, yeah, that's how it started.
What was their relationship?
They were very close. I mean, Ventura considered him a friend, and he was his informant. They worked a lot of jobs together, and the officer rented a house to the informant.
Which is highly unusual, isn't it?
Very unusual and not considered kosher. And so they were very, very close.
But they began to, I mean, clearly, and I guess the setup was that Martinez would go to try to buy drugs, and then Chudik and the officers would make the arrests. That's how it started, Wendy?
Right, that's correct. And I think, I just have to say on behalf of Officer Chudik that I could understand why he rented a house to Ventura Martinez, because he's a very likable guy, and he's very passionate. He cries a lot, you know, and he's the kind of guy that you want to help out. And I do think that it started out that Officer Chudik wanted to help him out. He needed a place to live with his family. But the problem was that when you do this work for the police department, you get paid for each job you do. So the money was going back to the officer for the rent. And then there was a built-in incentive to do more jobs. And that's really where things kind of went awry.
And how did they go awry?
Well, they went awry because one of the drug dealers recognized Ventura Martinez as the informant and told his attorney. His attorney hired a private investigator and got pictures of Ventura Martinez going into a house that he learned was owned by Jeffrey Chudik. And at that point, Ventura Martinez had, or the officer had asked him to make buys at certain houses. If he couldn't make the buy, the officer, according to Ventura Martinez, told him just, well, buy the heroin somewhere else, buy the cocaine somewhere else. And so that's where it started to completely unravel. And Ventura Martinez didn't feel right about this, and he knew that some of the buys were not good. Some of the search warrants were tainted.
And these were phonied up, I guess, search warrants. Wendy, can you explain sort of how this allegedly worked?
Yeah, it's the process is that the informant, who is never named in the search warrant, it's just Mr. Martinez was informant number 103, and they go and they make a buy, and it usually should be witnessed by two officers witnessing the person making the drug buy, and then at that point they go and they ask a judge or bail commissioner, whoever is sitting in the courthouse, for a search warrant, and they write the circumstances of the search warrant, and they say, you know, I saw informant 103 make a drug buy, and I have probable cause to believe that they're selling drugs out of this house or whatever.
And that's how it's supposed to work, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how did it work in this instance, and in these instances?
Well, in these instances, when they couldn't make a buy, or in some cases, you know, Ventura was reluctant to make the buy because he knew the people. I mean, this was somebody who came from North Philadelphia, who was very much entrenched in the hood, so to speak. And I mean, he moved in a dangerous world, in a very complicated world, almost like a wire, you know, kind of world. And so when he didn't feel comfortable making a buy from someone he knew, Officer Chudik would just tell him to get it from someplace else. And of course, he knew where to go get it from someplace else, because right. He knew every, you know. And that was the amazing thing about Ventura Martinez, is that he had an incredible memory. So when he first sat down with Barbara and myself, he could say, I didn't see the search warrant right here. I went over to this bar on the corner and I bought this here. And then I came back here and, you know, we said we made the buy. And in some cases, you know, you would knock on the door of a drug dealer and you would say, you know, can you tell us what happened? And they would say, I thought there was something wrong with that case, because that's not the kind of drugs I sell. I sell with this and not this, you know, this glassy and baggy.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker. And they just received a Pulitzer Prize for their investigative report here in Philadelphia for the Philadelphia Daily News, called Tainted Justice. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Christiana Care's Helen F. Graham Cancer Center, a National Cancer Institute selected community cancer center, supports WHYY. The Graham Cancer Center offers a team approach to cancer care, access to clinical trials, and personal care coordinators who guide patients throughout treatment. The Graham Center, a contributor to the National Institutes of Health's Cancer Genome Atlas Project, has expanded its facility on the Christiana Hospital campus in Newark, Delaware. Full details at christianacare.org/cancer.
This week on This American Life, for 7 months, a team of investigative journalists from the group ProPublica has been looking into a story for us, conducting dozens of interviews, poring over thousands of pages of financial documents. This week, we bring you the amazing story they uncovered, the inside story of one company that made hundreds of millions of dollars for itself while worsening the financial crisis for the rest of us. That's this week from Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. Ballet X supports WHYY. Ballet X is a contemporary dance company redefining ballet. Ballet X presents Spring Series, featuring four original dance works by Tung Dao, Lauren Putty, Myra Bazell, Monica Favand, and co-artistic director Christine Cox, who returns to perform as a company dancer. Ballet X Spring Series, April 14th through 18th at the Wilma Theater. Details at balletx.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, Daily News. Philadelphia Daily News reporters Barbara Laker and Wendy Ruderman were notified on Monday that they were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for their 2009 series Tainted Justice. And according to the Pulitzer citation, they received the award for, quote, their resourceful reporting that exposed a rogue police narcotics squad, resulting in an FBI probe and the review of hundreds of criminal cases tainted by the scandal. And Laker and Ruderman join us today on Radio Times to talk about the series, its impact, and the prize. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me talk about the other part of this series, which takes a look at some of these mom-and-pop stores here in Philadelphia, many of them owned by immigrants, and a number of them telling you about police officers coming in, cutting surveillance, you know, cords to surveillance cameras, arresting members of these, some of these moms and pops, and trashing the place, taking cash, taking money. And I wonder, Barbara, if I can just start with you about sort of where this part of the story started.
Well, we got a call from an attorney who represented one merchant who told us that this squad had raided his store and cut the surveillance camera wires and taken money. And so we listened to what he had to say, but we remembered from going through thousands and thousands of search warrants by all narcotics officers that we had seen search warrants for lots of other stores raided by this same squad.
And so this is the narcotics field squad.
Right, the narcotics field unit. So what we did is we sifted through all these search warrants, thousands of search warrants, and pulled every single warrant of a store raided by this squad. And then we split it up, and we went to every store that had been raided by this squad.
And why did the initial, I guess, why did the store owner contact you initially? Was it because of your reporting?
Yes.
About the confidential informant?
Yes. Right. Yes.
Actually, his attorney had called us, and when he was from, he was Jordanian, his attorney had called us and said, I have a client who you'd really want to talk to. He'd been reading these stories. And then when I got to the law office of the attorney, the bodega owner had backed out. He was too terrified to talk. And I guess his attorney thought he'd be happy to tell his story, but he really was very, very reluctant, even to the end.
Well, there are a number of stories detailed in here. One, and I want you to talk about it, Wendy, is about an only tobacco shop, an older Korean couple that owned the shop. And perhaps I'll put this to you, Barbara. What happened? Or what did they say happened?
Yeah, it was incredible. I went to the store, and they were an older Korean couple. They didn't speak English real well. You could tell that just by being in the store, I spent some time in the store. It was a legitimate, smoke shop business. And I did have a language barrier, but I kept going back, and I used, hand signals. I used everything I could to understand what they were saying. And what they said is, by using their hands and the English and a son also helped translate for me, that these officers had come in and literally smashed their cameras and looted their store and taken money. And these people had never been arrested before. And the woman, she really got to me because she said she was so scared that she peed in her pants when these officers came in because they thought they were being robbed.
These are plain clothes officers.
They're plain clothes officers, so they didn't even know that they were officers. This couple liked the police and wanted help from the police if they ever got robbed, so they were scared initially to talk. But they did tell their story, like all these other merchants did. And, they were really courageous. We feel all of them were courageous for going, not only telling us what happened, but going on the record with their name and everything.
And Wendy, the cops claimed that they were selling Ziploc bags considered to be drug paraphernalia or related to drug dealing.
Right, right. And I think that, like the relationship between Officer Chuddock and Ventura Martinez, this started out with good intentions, where people in the neighborhood, there was an outcry about these glassine bags, these little tiny Ziploc bags that you see littered on the sidewalk sometimes. And I agree, these bags are a big problem. And I know that when I'm at the playground with my kids and I see these bags strewn on the ground, I feel really like disgusted. Like I almost feel like the playground is poisoned, and I hope my kid doesn't pick this up and ask me what it is or put it in his pocket. But the problem is that these officers were aggressively going after these baggies, but in many cases, the bodega owners had no idea that they, I mean, some of them obviously they did know that it was being used for drugs, but others didn't really know that it was illegal because they could buy it legally from a wholesaler. And under the law, it's only a crime if the seller, the bodega owner, knows or should reasonably know that it's going to be used for drugs. So when the police want to do these busts, they have to send in somebody, an informant, to say, can I have some crack baggies? You have to use specific language. And a lot of these bodega owners said that they never, you know, they just said, can I have some baggies? And but I'm sure some of these bodega owners, they knew. But this was not a job for an elite narcotic squad. I felt like, really, if they had just sent in a regular beat cop to come in and say, you know, these are illegal, you know, I'm giving you a warning if I have to come back here again. And I think most of these bodega owners would have complied, because the alternative was they had a criminal record.
Sure,
they lost
sure.
their businesses in many cases. They were out thousands of dollars. They were horrified. It wasn't worth it.
But what you found was a pattern, was that the narcotics officers would raid these bodegas or these corner stores, but then either smash or cut their surveillance cameras. And then there were questions about discrepancies of cash. And a lot of these stores use cash. I mean, they're selling lottery tickets. People right. are buying sodas, things like that. So it is largely a cash business.
It is. They have a lot of cash. And these are people who don't trust banks. And so one of the women, one of the people in our story, they actually lost their store because she was an older Korean woman, right? Mm-hmm. And she had hidden most of her money that she was going to, she had hidden her money literally under her mattress because her family rented the room above the shop because they lived in the store. Mm-hmm. Though life is not easy, it's hard, and she didn't trust the bank, so she had thousands of dollars of cash under her mattress.
So how do you understand this cash discrepancy? And Barbara, what the store owners told you was that they had, you know, $10,000 of cash.
Right.
What got reported was something like $5,000 of cash by the police officers.
Right. The officers have to fill out a report saying how much money was recovered. And they legitimately can take that money. If they're doing a raid, they can take the money and mm-hmm. record it and record everything they take from the store. Or confiscate from the store. The problem was, in these instances, is there was a discrepancy with every single merchant we talked to, and it wasn't just cash. It was cigarettes, it was drinks, sodas, you know, candy, cell phone minutes. It was a variety of stuff that these merchants said had been taken, and we saw a pattern. And we were very careful, Wendy and I, in talking to the merchants to just ask them what happened. We didn't lead them on in any way. We didn't tell them, oh, did this happen? We just asked them what happened and to tell their story.
And when you talked to the police, what was their description or explanation of what was going on? Or did you talk to the police?
Well, we couldn't really get any comment from the officers per se, so we would have to ask the higher-ups in the police department. And they told us that it's not normal or not policy to smash cameras or surveillance cameras to do their job.
Commissioner Ramsey actually went on the record and said, I can't think of a single reason why during these raids you would need to destroy video surveillance cameras. And so I think he was upset, and he himself wanted an explanation.
Well, and another case, and I think this I don't know if this is exactly a smoking gun, but another store owner, Jose Duran, mm-hmm. in West Oak Lane, was able to capture some of this on tape. And again, Wendy, can you talk about that?
Yeah, after the first story ran, we got a call from Jose Duran, and his English was terrible, but he told me that he had a backup tape, and he had a very, very sophisticated video surveillance camera because he had gone to college for technology and was very interested in gadgetry, and he was kind of like a nerd. So I
did a backup of a backup of a backup.
Yes, right? He did, and it was downloading to a computer at his house, and he was very sophisticated. So as the police officers were in there, before they got and cut all of the wires, it was catching audio and video of the officers talking about how to cut the wires, which whether or not it went back to his house and his wife could see the video, they were really fixated on his surveillance system. And he had told us that he had one backup hidden behind like some bobby pins that he was selling in the store, you know. But he was really a smart guy. He just came across, I think the officers mistook him for being stupid because he didn't speak English.
But was this a smoking gun, Barbara, do you think? I mean,
well, it was something that when we could show the video to people and when we saw it initially, it showed, because it had audio, so you could hear the officers saying, how many eyes do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4. You could see them cut the wires or pull the wires. You could see it and hear what they were saying. And they weren't interested in the baggies, it seemed, as much as the cameras. And so I think that was really a step in the story that people could say, wow, like we can see it and hear them and, you know, what's going on here?
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Barbara Laker joining us along with Wendy Ruderman. And they just found out on Monday that they got a Pulitzer Prize for investigative journalism for a series that they wrote last year in 2009 called Tainted Justice. And it's about a rogue police narcotic squad here in Philadelphia, charges and allegations of going into small mom-and-pop shops, cutting surveillance cameras or smashing them, and discrepancies about money. Questionable warrants as well. Barbara Laker joined the Philadelphia Daily News in 1993, and Wendy Ruderman joined the Philadelphia Daily News in 2007. I do want to open up the lines for our listeners at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Wellington from Philadelphia to join us. Wellington, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Wellington Stubbs the second.
Hi, Wellington. And you got to tell, I know our guests know who you are, but you need to tell our listeners who you are.
Well, basically, I was the chief investigator for Philadelphia Police Advisory Commission. And Mr. Martinez had came to me first.
And that was the confidential informant, yes.
That is correct. And he had told me about what was happening and how his life was in danger. And how there was a hit on his life. And I interviewed him, and I believe he was very credible. As Wendy had earlier stated, he cried a lot, and there was a lot of sincerity in his voice and his posture, and I believe right what he was saying.
And who did he fear? Do you know, Wellington?
He basically feared this particular big-time drug dealer and the Narcotic Strike Force as well.
And the Narcotic Strike Force as well. Wendy, you want to add to that, Wendy?
Yeah.
You know Wellington, right?
Yes, I
Good
do.
Morning.
Hi.
Good morning,
Wellington, it's good to talk to you. I thought Wellington was really trying to figure out a way to protect Mr. Martinez, who was afraid that he was either going to get killed, because now his identity was outed, and the drug dealers knew who he was. They knew he was informant 103, and he had turned in a lot of people, and he was living among them. And he said he would wake up and find, like, cheese on his front door, like as in rat. And then on the other hand, he had Officer Chudik saying, get out of my house, like trying to disassociate himself. And he was afraid that he was afraid in his mind that one of the officers was going to hire somebody on the street to get rid of him.
Wow.
And so he had gone to Internal Affairs, and then he went to Wellington. And Wellington said, well, I don't know if I can protect your life. The Police Advisory Commission is a very small operation with a limited amount of resources and staff. And Wellington, you know, God bless him, he has so much courage. He just called me up and said, I'm going to send you over someone who maybe you'll be able to help, but I don't know if I can help him the way he needs to be helped. And he didn't even really, Wellington didn't really tell me what he was going to say or what it had any, I didn't know anything what it had to do with.
And Wellington, I'm curious what you make of the series that our guest wrote last year in the Philadelphia Daily News.
I loved it. It was excellent.
Do you have any question with it, or did it make sense to you?
Oh, it made absolutely sense, because that's what I investigate. Well, that's what I used to investigate.
Yeah, actually, Wellington ended up getting forced out of the Police Advisory Commission when it became known that he was the source that that sent Ventura Martinez to me. And how that happened was the FBI was very angry that Ventura Martinez had come to the Philadelphia Daily News before going to them, and it was going to make their investigation, rightly so, much more difficult. And they said, why did you do that? Why did you do that? And he said, well, I was only doing what the guy at the Police Advisory Commission told me to do. So he sort of like outed Wellington and really put him in a bad spot. And then the city really went after Wellington viciously, you know, saying that he had a residence in Trenton and he had a residence here, but he was spending more time in Trenton. And they the city controller's office, Alan Buckwitz, had done a whole investigation on him using all these resources and literally forced him out of the job. And I have to say that I thought he was really dedicated and just a good person with a lot of courage.
Well, Wellington, we appreciate your phone call to Radio Time. Thank you so much.
I thank you.
You're very welcome. Barb, if I can turn back to you and turn back to the police department, and part of the series that you did talked about some of the cookie cutter, I guess, warrants and questions about the kind of supervision or supervisory responsibilities overlooking this narcotic squad.
Right. We examined all the search warrants that this squad did, and we noticed that the language was exactly the same or very similar. Like, you know, they watched someone go up and make the buy, and it was often very cookie cutter. And so we thought, well, who's reading these search warrants? And so we thought we should look at that and ask the supervisors how that whole process worked, because it didn't make sense that supervisors would sign off on these and not ask, well, why do these all sound alike?
So what questions does that raise for you?
The questions that it raised for Wendy and I were, how could this happen and supervisors not know or not suspect that something might be going wrong? And why couldn't they pull these search warrants and talk to some of the people they'd arrested to find out what had really happened and dig deeper and have a closer eye on something that's very important for the police department?
Are there changes in the police department from what you know, Wendy?
Yes, to the police department's credit, they did take seriously the articles, and Commissioner Ramsey, along with other top brass at the police department, enacted, you know, they updated an informant directive that hadn't been updated in like 20 years, talking about really laying out what you can and cannot do with your informant. They put in place stricter regulations, more oversight, more careful scrutiny of the search warrants to make sure that they don't all sound alike. Payments to informants must be witnessed by a supervisor. I mean, they really put in a lot of layers. And some of my police sources actually complained about it to me because it's a lot of paperwork and it's a lot of work. And in some regards, it's unrealistic. Every time you have to talk to a police informant, every time you contact one of your informants or they contact you, you have to tell your supervisor about it. And a lot of my narcotic sources are like, you have no idea what a pain in the butt that is and how unreasonable it is. I think that the oversight was warranted in this case.
You know? Which allowed this to go on, I guess, much too long.
Yeah, I mean, these officers were decorated officers, very aggressive. They were like the favorite children of the department, and they got out there and they got the job done. But people had told us that in getting the job done, they had cut corners, which I understand that.
Let's take a very short break. We'll pick up on that. And that's Wendy Ruderman, who joins us along with Barbara Laker. Both of them just received a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. And both of them are reporters at the Philadelphia Daily News. The series that ran last year is called Tainted Justice. We are talking about how they put the series together, what they found, and we'll be talking more about some of the changes and some of the other investigations, including FBI investigation as well. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Grows Solar, installing solar power systems in Pennsylvania and nationwide. Offering solar site evaluations and financing information at grosolar.com or 800-GO-SOLAR.
The brain in middle age gets easily distracted and forgets, but new research finds it's better at seeing the big picture and comprehending complexity. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Barbara Strauch, author of The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain. She's health and medical science editor at the New York Times. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Jane Clayson. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Most states allow people to openly carry handguns in public, but should they? Also, the story of the struggle for survival after a sailboat capsizes in the middle of a storm. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by Clear Mobile Internet. Clear's 4G WiMAX network covering Philly is designed to allow users to stream TV, movies, or public radio all over town. Clear, now covering Philly. Information at clear.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Barbara Laker and Wendy Ruderman about their series that just won a Pulitzer Prize called Tainted Justice. It's about a rogue squad of narcotics police officers in Philadelphia accused of terrorizing mom-and-pop stores, falsifying warrants and drug arrests, and their stories launched local and FBI investigations led to a series of reforms within the police department. We're talking about how they put the story together, what they found, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And there's so many pieces of this story. I do want to get back to you, Barbara, but talking about these police officers, the ones that are accused of going in and raiding these bodegas. Wendy, where are they today?
They are actually off the street on desk duty, and they've been on desk duty, I guess it's been almost over a year now, as the FBI investigation progresses. And we hear rumors about, like, little rumblings about the investigation, but we're not kept informed in any way about it. And
does that affect the kind of work that you can do, knowing that the FBI is also investigating this or has been investigating this?
Yes, in some regards, it's harder to get information. It's harder to know what was going on. Because initially, Barbara and I were leading the investigation, so to speak, because we had a head start. And now it's sort of the other way around, where they are way ahead of us, and we need them for information. Of course, they're not going to share it, you know.
Have you ever interviewed any of the police officers in question, Shuttick, for instance?
Yeah, actually, Barbara attended he was trying to evict Ventura Martinez from his house, and he actually showed up at landlord-tenant court, and Barbara got to meet him and talk
to
him.
Early, yeah, this was early on in our investigation, and I went to landlord-tenant court because I knew that the officer was trying to evict the informant, and he didn't know what I looked like or anything. And in fact, an internal affairs officer was in court too, because he was interested in this. And so I just went up to the officer after landlord-tenant court, because it got Martinez got real emotional. He was crying in court because he was trying to tell the judge, you know, like, he was my friend and now he's trying to evict me, and he was trying to tell the judge he was an informant. And the judge really didn't want to hear all this stuff. He just was interested in whether he was going to get evicted. So I went into the hallway and I introduced myself to the officer, and he said, "Look, I'm just the landlord." And he was very polite to me. He was very courteous, and he told me he'd talk to me later. But as the investigation grew, he got an attorney, and I've never talked to him since.
And the attorney has said some public things about the two of you.
Oh yes, he was the one who held the press conference to try to, you know, discredit all our work.
Has anyone, I mean, I know papers and investigative pieces have to go through a fine-tooth comb. Has anyone questioned or sued the paper or threatened suit, or any legal action been filed because of this reporting, Wendy?
No, although the attorney for Jeffrey Chudik, George Paquetto, he did imply over and over again that he was going to file suit. And in fact, at the press conference, he said that he had been intending to file suit, but since the paper filed for bankruptcy, that was his excuse, the paper filed for bankruptcy, he wasn't able to do it. But no, we've had no legal ramifications.
Barbara, let me turn back to you. And another part of this story is three women claim that they were sexually molested in home raids. What do they say?
Well, we found one woman by accident when we were talking to a couple who had been raided. And the husband wasn't home, and she was home, and she told me, I mean, she was crying when she told me that she was taken to the back of the house, like behind the kitchen, by one officer, and he fondled her breasts. She thought she was going to be raped, and she was petrified. He said he'd come back to get her, and she didn't know his name. So we reported what she said, but we couldn't say who it was, you know. So then when we had, earlier we had that video surveillance by Jose Duran. And
the one in West Oak Lane, yes.
Right. So she could, and all we did was we showed her the surveillance video. And she, because for online at first, we had the faces of the cops like distorted so no one could see because they're undercover, and we did that to protect their identity. But we showed her the video, and she identified this particular officer, Thomas Tolstoy, to us. At the same time, we had other sources, police sources, telling us that they had heard that this officer had done this to other women, and Tolstoy had been taken off the street previously. We didn't have any names. We had no addresses. We had nothing to go on. So what we did is we went through these thousands of search warrants. Wendy and I huddled together. We matched his badge number, and we pulled every raid that this officer, Tolstoy, had been on. And we tried to figure out if a woman had been in the house from the search warrant, but often we couldn't tell. So we split it up and literally went to hundreds of houses and asked the people what happened during the raid.
And what did you find?
Well, what we found was amazing. One of the women we found, her house where the raid had happened was boarded. A neighbor told me that right after the raid, this woman had come out of the house crying and saying that she was scared to death. And I thought maybe that's the woman we're looking for. He was so helpful. He helped me by finding neighbors and other friends who helped me find her. I went to her house that I thought was possibly where she lived at like 8:30 on a Friday night. She wasn't home. When she eventually got home, she got out of the car. A cousin went up to her and said, "A reporter's here to talk to you about what happened during the raid." And she walked up to me, hugged me, and said, "I've been praying for this day."
Wow. Has Internal Affairs looked at these cases, these allegations,
yes,
these charges?
Yes, they have. And what's so courageous about these women is two of the three went on the record with their name and did videos saying what happened to them. They all identified the officer. They've all talked to Internal Affairs. We talk to them separately. They don't know each other. They don't have criminal records. But their courage is amazing to me because they're scared women.
And I do want to get back to our callers, but to you, Wendy, helping us understand who these people are that we've been talking about. Some of them are immigrants that own some of these corner stores. Others are I would say, probably poor people living in the city, a city that has 25% poverty rate, mm-hmm. And in you know, dangerous parts of the city as well. Also, lots of drugs in this part of the city. As much as some of these allegations are about planting drugs or misusing warrants, there still is a lot of drugs involved in this story as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I don't have any sympathy for drug dealers, but I guess I was interested in their story because I just felt like, if what they were saying was true, how could it be that, you know, law enforcement was breaking the law to enforce the law? And
and is that how you see it?
Well, you know, if I believe what they tell me, and I do, yeah, I hold police officers to a higher standard. I admit it. I live by police officers. They all live on my block, and I'm in awe of them, you know. And so I hold them up higher. My sons do. And when they break the law, I feel disappointed.
Well, and Barbara, too, for these mom-and-pop stores, these immigrants, many of them coming from countries where you probably feared the police, thinking they had come to this country where the police is your friend.
Right. They had tremendous fear of the police. And I think also we do have to acknowledge, like, this squad did take a lot of big-time drug dealers off the street, and their job is not easy. And to a lot of big-time drug dealers won't sell to an undercover person. They just won't. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of, I mean, we respect what they do. We think when it's done right, it's because no neighbor wants drugs on their block. I think where it got muddied is where they started saying that drugs were being bought from a house where it wasn't being bought, and then it just mushroomed into something where the line was crossed, and it got to the point where these mom and pop people, like these mom and pop stores and regular merchants and people who had no criminal record, were being victimized.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. James from Bedminster joins us on Radio Times. James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, first, I'd like to congratulate both you ladies. That's quite an accomplishment.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I definitely have witnessed firsthand the police not following procedures as far as legal search and seizure. In the 90s, I was I smoked marijuana, and I knew a couple storefront stores you'd go in and purchase it. And every Christmas, I kind of befriended a couple of the owners there, and every Christmas, police would come in and take money and drugs, not arrest anyone, and just not, you know, follow proper procedure. And I just think that having a better oversight, I'm not condoning any kind of, this was a long time ago, mm-hmm. but just to have, you know, you write a story and exposing some of the inconsistencies in police work, I think is it's very good, and hopefully some positive changes will come about.
And James, just a quick question. Are you talking about Philadelphia, or are you talking about someplace else?
Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia.
Hmm.
Wendy, any thoughts? Well, I'm thinking about the 39th District scandal, I guess, which has some of the same features that we've been talking about.
Yeah, well, what's really hard to understand is it seems like every 10 years or so there's some police scandal in Philadelphia, and some of the problems that are mentioned in the reports that come out of these investigations are the lack of oversight, that the narcotics officers are particularly vulnerable to crossing the line because of all the drugs and the money.
The cash,
and
right?
The cash. You know, Ventura Martinez once told us that he was short on child support money, and he says that Officer Chudik pulled out like all these crinkled up ones that you get off, you know, that he felt came from off the street, and just gave him money to pay for child support. So there's been all of this, all of these reports and all of this scrutiny, but then it just seems like over time, all of that is like nobody remembers it.
Interesting. James, thanks for the call. Let me get Robert from University City to join us on Radio Times. Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Congratulations as well. A related question about the sort of press resources needed to do this kind of work. I know you've had shows. We hear a lot about the financial plight of newspapers, the economic model not working. I'm wondering a couple things. First, quickly, you know, short of a paper like the News or the Inquirer, is there anyone else who's doing this kind of investigative work that's so important? And even more frightening, without local papers and those communities without local papers, is it just not being done at all? That it, you know, where we're reliant on a USA Today or even a good national paper in some cities. I mean, is this all that stands between sort of a softball question, but all that stands between
sure.
corruption is the financial model of the newspapers in the cities where we read them? And I'll take the answer off the air,
no.
but I'm just wondering, could this have been done had you not worked for a large corporate newspaper?
Well, it's a good question, and one we actually talked about before even going on the air. I'll toss this back to you, Barbara Laker.
We couldn't have done this without the reporters we work with, our editor, Gard Joseph, who believed in us, and Michael Days, the editor of the paper, who, I mean, what they let us do is basically do this story exclusively.
For a year.
Mm-hmm. Which meant that all the other reporters we work with were doing 2, 3, 4 stories a day mm-hmm. and picking up slack because they were letting us roam the streets and do what we wanted to do and work on this story. And they believed in it. And I think that in today's world of journalism, that you have to pick your fight. You have to pick the work you're going to do. And we were lucky enough to have people who believed in us and allowed us to do it, and other reporters who didn't resent us but picked up the slack for us.
And I noticed even some of the other Pulitzer Prize winners, Wendy, were local papers. I mean, looking at local stories. And to me, it just, as Robert was saying, just underscores the need for, if not newspaper, certainly local journalism.
Absolutely. I mean, we didn't think that our piece would win or have any kind of chance, only because it was total, from the ground up, shoe leather journalism, which is why I drank out of my shoe when we won. I was very embarrassed.
Did you really?
I drank champagne out of my sneaker because this piece was as high-tech as our sneakers. We went door-to-door. I mean, the people who win the Pulitzer, you know, they you know, have Ivy League education, and they know how to use Excel spreadsheets, and they did really well on their SATs, and they're not tabloid papers, you know? Like, we were like the
so you
little...
you broke all the rules here,
we're like
right?
the little engine that could. You know, this was really very low-tech. We had MapQuest printouts all over, littered on the floor of our cars, and I finally got a GPS because I was so tired of, you know, printing out directions for going to A to B to C to D and then having it all over the floor. So, so yeah, when I got my GPS, we hit the big time.
And to you, Barbara, there are a number of cases that are being looked at, or I guess re-looked at, as a result of this investigation.
Hundreds of cases are being looked at, been put on hold, and some have been dropped because the prosecution doesn't think they can win it because, you know, if the informant says, no, I didn't make that buy. And Ventura Martinez is not just like... he is so believable. I mean, if he told us there was a street with a tree on one end and a garage on the other and a house in the middle with a yellow awning and a red door, that's what we found. And I think that because we, you know, at first didn't know what to believe, and he came through every single time.
We're almost out of time here, Wendy, but I'm thinking about those shop owners, the ones who had all the raids. Are they still in business? Are they still in Philadelphia? I know you talked to a number of them.
Yeah, some of them are still in business. Some of them are not, and they're actually still trying. They're in forfeiture court trying to get back some money. Some are still, you know, trying to get their criminal records overturned. One of them is afraid of being deported because, you know, now there's this law that if you are convicted of a crime and then you are, you know, a foreign national, they can still deport you. So they call us frequently. They ask if we've heard anything about the investigation. We ask if they've heard anything about the investigation. And we stay in touch with them. And what's really unique about their voices is, you know, they're Koreans and Dominicans and Colombians and Jordanians and Israelis, and they told us their stories in all different languages, the exact same story. And I just can't imagine why this was going on in plain sight.
Well, I'm sure the story will continue, and I congratulate you both again for an extraordinary series. Wendy Ruderman, Barbara Laker, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're very welcome. And the series called Tainted Justice just received the Pulitzer Prize for investigative journalism, and it ran last year in the Philadelphia Daily News. And our guests have been Barbara Laker and Wendy Ruderman, both reporters at the Philadelphia Daily News. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program, including leaving us an email, podcast, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and whyy.org, member-supported public media.